Muhammad Rasulullah, The Apostle of Mercy by Abul Hasan Ali Nadwi. Chapter 5. Makkah, the Prophet's Birthplace, the Metropolis. Those not conversant with the conditions in Makkah at the time of the Prophet's birth, nor familiar with social life, history, legends, literature and poetry of Arabia during the pre-Islamic times, picture Makkah in their mind's eye as a hamlet with few tents of goats, hair scattered here and there, surrounded by sheep, horses, camels, and half-clad women and children, with narrow alleys flanked by sharp, jagged hilltops. They view the people as ignominal and beggarly, passing through the stage of cultural and intellectual infancy, having no aesthetic sense, polish or refinement, and the people who took stale bread and half-baked mutton and wore clothes made of camel's hair. Such a poor and miserable picturization of Makkah is inconsistent with the unmistaken landscape of the city emerging from historical records, the collection of pre-Islamic poetry, the habits and customs, norms and traditions of the Arabs. The people of Makkah had been drawn into a stream of urban culture from the earlier ritual nomadic existence. To tell the truth, such a vile and mean view of Makkah is not in keeping with the Quranic description of the city, which gives it the names, the mother of the towns, as is said in the Quran. Quote, "And thus we have inspired in you a lecture in Arabic, that you may warn the mother town and those around it, and may warn of a day of assembly, whereof there is no doubt, a host will be in the garden and a host of them in the flame." And another place, Makkah is designated as a land made safe. Quote, "By the fig and the olive, by Mount Sinai, and by this land made safe." And in the Quran it also is called a city. Quote, "Nay, I swear by this city, and you are an indweller of this city." Unquote. Makkah had, as a matter of fact, already passed from nomadic existence to a stage of urban civilization by the middle of the 5th century. The city was ruled by a confederacy based on mutual cooperation, unity of purpose, and a general consensus on division of administrative and civil functions between self-governing clans. And this system had already been brought into existence by Qusay bin Kilab. Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, became fifth in line of succession to Qusay bin Kilab, and latter can be placed in the middle of the 5th century. Makkah, thinly populated in the beginning, was located between two hills called Jabal Abu Qusayb, that is adjacent to Mount Safa, and Jabal Ahmar, known as Araf during the pre-Islamic days, opposite the valley of Qunayqa. The population of the town increased gradually, owing partly to the reverence paid to the Kaaba and the regardful position of its priests and attendants, and partly because of the peace prevailing in the vicinity of the sanctuary. The tents and the shacks had been given places to houses made of mud and stone, and habitation had spread over the hills and low-lying valleys around Kaaba. The outset, the people living in Makkah abstained from constructing even their housetops in the rectangular shape like the Kaaba, since they considered it to be a sign of disrespect to the house of God. But gradually the ideas changed. Still, they kept the height of their houses lower than that of the Kaaba. As related by certain people, the houses were initially made in circular shapes as a mark of respect to the Kaaba. The first rectangular house to be built was reported to be built by Humayd bin Zuhair, was looked at by disfavor by the Quraysh. The chief and other well-to-do people among the Quraysh usually built their houses of stones and had many rooms in them with two doors on opposite sides so that the women folk did not feel inconvenience in the presence of the guests. Reconstruction of Makkah. Qusay bin Kilab had played a leading role in the reconstruction expansion of Makkah. The Quraysh had been dispersed over a wide area, were brought together by him in the valley of Makkah. He allocated areas for settlement of different families and encouraged them to construct their houses in specified localities. The successors of Qusay continued to consolidate the living quarters and to allocate spare lands to new families coming into Makkah. This process continued peacefully for a long time, with the result that habitation of the Quraysh and their confederate clans grew up, making Makkah a flourishing city. The city-state. Qusay bin Kilab and his family had assumed a commanding position over the city and its inhabitants. They were janitors of the Kaaba, had the privilege of saqaya, which is watering of the pilgrims, and arranging the annual feast, presided over by the meetings of the House of Assembly, that is Dar al-Nadwa, and attended and handing out war banners. Qusay bin Kilab had built the House of Assembly close to the Kaaba, with one of its doors leading to the sanctuary. It was used both as a living quarters by Qusay and rendezvous for discussing all matters of common weal by Qusay and the Quraysh. No man or woman got married, no discussion of any important matter was held, no declaration of war was made, and no sheet of cloth was cast on the head of any girl reaching marriageable age except in this house. Qusay's authority during his life and after his death was deemed sacrosanct, like religious injunctions which could not be violated by anyone. The meetings of the House of Assembly could be attended only by the Quraysh and their confederate tribesmen, that is, those belonging to Hashim, Umayyah, Makhzum, Joma, Saham, Taim, Adi, Asad, Nawfal, and Zuhra, whatever be their age, while people of other tribes not only below the age of 40 were allowed to participate in their meetings. After the death of Qusay, the offices were held by him were divided between different families. Banu Hashim were given the right of watering pilgrims. The standard of Quraysh called Aqab went to Banu Umayyah. Banu Nufail were allocated Rifada. Bani Abduddar were designed and assigned priesthood, wardening of the Kaaba and the standard of war. Bani Asad held the charge of the House of Assembly. These people of the Quraysh used to entrust the responsibilities to notable people belonging to their family. Thus, Abu Bakr, the companion of the Prophet, who came from Banu Taim, was responsible for releasing blood money, fines, and gratuity. Khalid bin Walid of Banu Makhzum held charge of the apparatus of war, kept in a tent during the peacetime and on horsebacks during the battles. Umar ibn al-Khattab was sent as an envoy of the Quraysh to other tribes with whom they intended to measure swords, or where a tribe bragging of its superiority wanted the issue to be decided by a war. Safwan bin Umayyah of Banu Joma played at the dice, which was deemed essential before undertaking any important task, and Harith bin Qusay Qais was liable to perform all administrative businesses besides the custodian of offering to the idols kept in the Kaaba. The duties allocated to these people were hereditary offices held earlier by their grandfathers or their forefathers. Commercial operations. The Quraysh of Makkah used to fit out two commercial caravans, one to Syria during the summer and other to Yemen during the winter. The 4 months of Hajj, that is Rajab, Dhiqada, Dhilhijjah, and Muharram, were deemed sacred when it was not lawful to engage in hostilities. During these months, the precincts of the Holy Temple and the open place besides it were utilized as a trade center for which people from distant places came for transacting business. All the necessities required by the Arabs were easily available in the market of Makkah. The stones for the sale of various commodities, located in different lanes and byways mentioned by the historians, tend to show the economic and cultural growth of Makkah. The vendors of attar, which is the perfume, used to have their stalls in separate by lanes and were the shops of fruit sellers, barbers, grocers, fresh dates, and other wares and trades localized in different alleys. A number of these markets were spacious enough, as for example, the market set apart for fruit grains was well stocked with wheat, clarified butter, honey, and similar other commodities. All these articles were brought by trading caravans. To cite an instance, wheat was brought to Makkah from Yamama. Similarly, cloth had and shoes had separate quarters allocated to them inside the market. Makkah had also a few meeting places where carefree young men used to come together for diversion and pastime. Those who were prosperous and accustomed to living high lives spent the winter in Makkah and the summer in Ta'if. There were even some smart young men known for their costly dresses costing several hundred dirhams. Makkah was a center of lucrative trade, transacting business on a large scale. Its merchant convoys and caravans to different countries in Asia and Africa and imported almost everything of necessity and wares marketable in Arabia. They usually brought resin, ivory, gold, ebony from Africa, hides and incense, spices, sandalwood and saffron from Yemen, different oils and food grains, armor, silk and wines from Egypt and Syria, cloth from Iraq, gold, tin and precious stones and ivory from India. The wealthy merchants of Makkah sometimes presented the products of their city, of which the most valued were leather products, to the kings and nobles of other countries. When the Quraysh sent Abdullah bin Abu Rabia or Amr bin As to Abyssinia to bring back the Muslim fugitives, they sent them with leather goods of Makkah as gifts to Najashi and his generals. Women also took part in commercial undertaking and fitted out their caravans for Syria and other countries. Khadija bin Khuwailid and Hanzaliyah, the mother of Abu Jahl, were two merchant women of dignity and wealth. The following verse of the Quran attests to the freedom of women to ply a trade. Quote, "Unto men a fortune from what which they have earned, and unto women a fortune from what they have earned." Unquote. Like other advanced nations of the world, commercially minded citizens of Makkah had based their economy on commerce, for which they sent out caravans in different directions, organized stock markets and created favorable conditions in the home markets for the visiting tourists and traders. This helped to increase fame and dignity of Makkah as a religious center and contributed in no means a measure to the prosperity of the city. Everything required by the people of Makkah, whether a necessity or a luxury, reached their hands because of the city's commercial importance. This fact finds a reference in the verse of the Quran, quote, "So let them worship the house of Lord, who has fed them against hunger and has made them safe from fear." Unquote. Economic conditions, weights and measures. Makkah was thus the chief center of big business in Arabia, and its citizens were prosperous and wealthy. The caravan of the Quraysh involved in the Battle of Badr, while returning from Syria, consisted of thousands of camels and carried merchandise worth 50,000 dinars. One dinar is 100 dirhams. Both the Byzantinian and the Syrian currencies, known as dirham and dinar, were in general in use in Makkah and other parts of the peninsula. Dirham was of two kinds. One was an Iranian coin known to the Arabs as baghilia and sauda, dhamia, and the other was a Byzantine coin, which is a Greek drachme, which was called Byzantinia. These were silver coins, and therefore instead of using them as units of coins, the Arabs reckoned their values according to their weights. The standard weight of dirham, according to the doctors of the Islamic Sharia, is equal to 55 grains of barley, and 10 dirhams is equivalent in weight to 7 mithqals of gold. One mithqal of pure gold, however, according to Ibn Qasir, equal to the weight of 72 grains of barley. Doctors of law unanimously agree with the weights given by Ibn Khaldun. The coins in current use during the time of the Prophet were generally silver coins. Atta states that the coins in general during the period were not gold, but they were silver coins. Dinar was gold coins familiar to the Arabs as the Byzantinian coin in circulation in Syria and Hijaz during the pre-Islamic and early Islamic period. It was minted by Byzantinians with the image and name of the emperor impressed on it, as stated by Ibn Abdul Bar in the Al-Tahud. Old Arabic manuscripts mention the Latin dinaris as the Byzantinian coin, which is stated to have the name of a coin still a unit of currency in Yugoslavia. New Testament too mentions dinaris at various places. Dinar was considered to have the average weight of one mithkal, which as stated above was equivalent to 72 grains of barley. It is generally believed that the weight standards of the dinar was maintained from pre-Islamic days down to the 4th century of Hijra. The different books say that Byzantinian dinaris weighed 425 grams and hence, according to the Orientalists, the mithkal of Makkah was about 425 grams. The ratio of weight between dirham and dinar was 7:10 and the former weighed 7/10 of the mithkal. The par value of the dinar deduced from the hadith, the fiqh and historical literature as equivalent to 10 dirhams, not 100 as mentioned before. Amr bin Suhaib, as quoted in the Sunan, Abu Dawood relates, the blood money during the time of the Prophet was 8,000 dirhams or 800 dinars, which was followed by the companions of the Prophet until the entire Muslim community unanimously agreed to retain it. The authentic hadiths fix the nisab or the amount of property upon which zakat is due in terms of dirhams and not in terms of dirhams at 20 dinars, that means 200 dirhams. This rule, upheld by a consensus of doctors of law, goes to show that during the earlier period of the Islamic era and even before it, a dinar was deemed to have par value of 10 dirhams or other coins equivalent to them. Imam Malik says in the Muwatta that the accepted rule without any difference of opinion is that zakat is due on 200 dirhams. The weight and measures is in general use in those days were mud, ratal, mithkal, to which few others were later on added. The Arabs also possessed knowledge of arithmetic, for it is evident that the Quran has relied on their ability to compute the shares of the descendants in promulgating inheritance laws of Islam. The prosperous families of the Quraysh. Banu Umayyah, Banu Makhzum were two prominent families of the Quraysh, favored by the stroke of luck. Walid bin Mughira and Abdul Uzza, that is Abu Lahab, Abu Uhya bin Sa'id bin Umayyah, had shares of 30,000 dinars in the caravans of Abu Sufyan, and Abu Rabia al-Makhzumi also had good fortunes. Abdullah bin Jaban of Banu Taim was one of the wealthiest people of Makkah, who used to drink water in a cup of gold and maintained a public kitchen for providing food to every poor and beggar. Abbas bin Abdul Muttalib was another man abounding in riches who spent lavishly on the needy and lent money on interest in Makkah. During his farewell pilgrimage, when the apostle abolished various transactions, he declared, "The first usury abolished today is that of Abbas bin Abu Muttalib." Unquote. Makkah also had men rolling in riches whose well-furnished drawing rooms were the rendezvous points for the elite of the Quraysh, who rejoin in the pleasures of wine, love and romance. The chiefs of the Quraysh usually had their sittings in front of the Kaaba, in which prominent poets of pre-Islamic days, such as Labid, recited their poems, and it was here that Abu Muttalib used to have his gatherings, and as they say, his sons dared not take their seats around him until their father had arrived. Culture and arts. Industrial arts and culture were looked down upon by the Quraysh. They considered it beneath their dignity to have their hands in a handiwork. Manual occupations were regarded as occupations meant exclusively for the slaves or the non-Arabs. Yet, notwithstanding this proclivity of the Quraysh, certain crafts were a dire necessity and were practiced by some of them. Khabbab is reported to have been engaged in manufacturing of swords. Constructional activities that were indispensable, but the Iranians and the Byzantine worksmen were employed to do the work of the Quraysh. A few men in Makkah knew the art of reading and writing, but the Arabs as a whole were ignorant of the ways by which the learning is imparted. The Quran also calls them Ummi, or an unlettered people. Quote, "He, it is who, has sent down upon the unlettered ones a messenger of their own." Unquote. The message, the people of Mecca were, however, not ignorant to the arts of civilization. Their refined taste, polish, and cultural excelled them in the whole of Arabia in the same way as the townsmen of any metropolis occupy a distinctive place in their country. The languages spoken at Mecca were regarded as a model of unapproachable excellence. The Meccan dialect set the standards which the desert Bedouin as well as the Arabs of outlying areas strived to imitate. By virtue of their elegant expression, eloquence, the inhabitants of Mecca were considered to possess the finest tongue and uncorrupted by the grossness of the language of the non-Arabs. In their physical features, shapeliness and good looks, the people of Mecca were considered to be the best representatives of the Arabian race. They were also endowed with the virtues of courage and magnanimity of heart, acclaimed by the Arabs as Al-Futuh and also Al-Murawah, which were two often repeated themes of Arabian poetry. These traits of their character admirably describe their recklessness, which savored both a devil and a saint. The matters that attracted their attention most were genealogy, the legend of Arabia, poetry, astrology, planetary mansions, ominous flight of the birds, and a little of meditation. An expert horseman, they possessed an intimate knowledge of the horse and preserved the memory of the purest breed, and as dwellers of the desert, they were well versed in the delicate art of lineage. Their therapy, based partly on their own experience and partly on the traditional methods handed out to them from their forefathers, consisted of branding and removal of diseased limbs and use of certain herbs. Military prowess. The Quraysh were by nature or nurture a peace-loving people, amiable in disposition, for unlike all other people inside or outside the peninsula, their prosperity depended on the development of free trade, continual movement of caravans, improvement of marketing facilities in their own city, and maintenance of conditions peaceful enough to encourage merchants and pilgrims to bend their steps to Mecca. They were sufficiently far-sighted to recognize that their mercantile business was their life. Trade was the source of their livelihood as well as the means to increase their prestige as the servants of the sanctuary Kaaba. The Quran also referred to this fact in Surat Quraysh. Quote, "So let them worship the Lord of this house, who has fed them against hunger and has made them safe from fear." Unquote. In other words, they were inclined to avoid war unless their tribal or religious honor was in peril. They were committed to the principle of peaceful coexistence. Nevertheless, they possessed considerable military power. Their courage and intrepidity was an axiom throughout, which was an example throughout Arabia for their skills in horsemanship. Anger of Mudar, which is a book which has described as a tormenting thirst quenched by nothing except blood, was a well-known adage of the Arabic language, frequently used by the poets and orators of pre-Islamic Arabia. The military prowess of the Quraysh was not restricted to their own tribal reserves alone. They utilized the services of Ahabish or the desert Arabs living around Mecca. Some of them traced their descendants to Kinana and distinct relations to Quraysh. The Khuza'a were also confederates of the Quraysh. In addition, Mecca also had slaves in considerable numbers who were willing to fight for their masters. They could only thus draft at any time several thousand warriors under their banner. The strongest army, numbering 10,000 combatants ever mustered in the pre-Islamic era, was enlisted by the Quraysh in the Battle of Ahzab. Mecca, the heart of Arabia. By virtue of being the seat of national shrine and also the most flourishing commercial center, whose inhabitants were culturally and intellectually ahead of the country, Mecca had secured a preeminent position in Arabia. It was considered as a rival of Sana'a in Yemen, but with the Byzantine and the Abyssinians and the Iranians gaining control over Sana'a one after another, the decline of the earlier glamour of Hira and Ghassan, Mecca had attained the place of undisputed supremacy in Arabia. The moral life. The moral ideals was that the Makkans lacked most of all, or one can say except for the binding force of some stale customs and traditional sentiments of Arab chivalry, they had no code of ethics to guide their conduct. Gambling was a favorite pastime in which they took pride, and unrestrained drunkenness sent them into rapturous delight, and immoderate dispositions satisfied their perverted sense of honor. Their gatherings were a sense of drinking bouts and debauchery. Without any idea of sin or crime, they never took any aversion to wickedness, iniquity, callousness, and bringage. The moral atmosphere of Arabia in general, and that of Mecca in particular, was faithfully depicted by Ja'far ibn Abu Talib, a prominent member of the Quraysh, in the court of Najashi, when he said to him, "O King, we were an unlightened people. Plunged in ignorance, we worshipped the idols, we ate dead animals, and we committed abominations. We broke natural ties, we ill-treated our neighbors, and our strong devoured the weak." Unquote. Religious life. The religious practices and belief of the Arabs were beyond no doubt even more despicable, and particularly for the reason of influence they exerted on the social and moral life of the people. Having lost all but little touch with the teachings of the prophets of the yesteryears, they had been completely submerged in the crude and materialistic ways of fetishes like that of prevailing in the countries surrounding them. So fond they were of idol worship that no less than 360 idols are ordained or defiled the Kaaba, the holy sanctuary. The greatest among them was Hubal, whom Abu Sufyan was exalting at the Battle of Uhud when he cried out, "Glory be to Hubal." The idol occupied a central place in the Kaaba by the side of a well in which the offerings were stored. Sculptured in the shape of a man, it was made of a huge rock. As it had a right hand missing when the Quraysh had discovered it, they had replaced it with a hand made of gold. Two idols had been placed in front of the Kaaba, and one was called Isaf and the other Naila, and the former had been installed close to the Kaaba and the latter at the place of Zamzam. After some time, the Quraysh had shifted the first one near the other, where they were offering sacrifices besides them. On the mounts of Safa and Marwa were two more idols. Every household in Makkah had an idol, which was worshipped by the inmates of the people of the house. Al-Uzza had been installed near Arafah, within the temple constructed for it. Quraysh venerated Al-Uzza as the chief or the noblest of all the gods. The Arabs used to cast lots with the help of divining arrows placed before these idols for making decisions to commence any affair. There were also other idols. One of them was named Al-Khalsa and had been set up in the deprivation of Makkah Valley. The idol was garlanded, presented an offering of barley and wheat, and bathed with milk. The Arabs used to make sacrifice and hang the eggs of ostriches over it. Being a popular idol, its replicas were sold by vendors to the villagers and pilgrims visiting Makkah. The Arabs possessed the virtue of courage, loyalty, and generosity, but during the night long of superstition and ignorance, worship of images and idols had stolen into their heart, perhaps more firmly than any other nation. They had wandered far away from the simple faith of their ancestors, Ibrahim and Ismail, which had once taught them the true meaning of religious piety, purity of morals, and seemliness in conduct. So, this was the city of Mecca by the middle of the 6th century, before the birth of the Prophet, where we see Islam rising on the horizon, shrouded in obscure darkness. In the very truth, the Lord has said, quote, "And you may warn the folks whose fathers were not warned, so they were heedless." Jazakallah khair. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.